All right. Hello, everyone. Good evening. As Ken mentioned, we are here for I Am That. And the last time we were here for I Am That was 2 weeks ago. And I looked at message four, which is called Real World is Beyond the Mind. And although that is a few words from the from the message, it's not it, that name is not really, at least in my humble opinion, a good descriptor of what the message was about. What the message was really about was cause and effect, or as Nisargadatta was saying, that cause and effect is not really true, because there isn't a cause for an effect. Everything makes everything. Everything in the world as it is what creates the next moment of everything in the world as it is. And one, the last paragraph is a paragraph that, because I was running near the end of the hour, I went ahead and read it pretty quickly. But after the hour ended and I went to bed and I was laying in bed, the last paragraph kept working on me. So I thought that today I would come back to that last paragraph in that message, look at that last paragraph, and then move on to the next message. So let me read that last paragraph to you. The questioner had asked, to what extent is desire a causal factor? And this was the answer, which is the last paragraph. One of many. For everything, there are innumerable causal factors. But the source of all that is the infinite possibility, and this is capitalized, capital I, capital P. The source of all that is the infinite possibility, the supreme reality, which is in you and which throws its power and light and love on every experience. But this source is not a cause, and no cause is a source. Because of that, I say everything is uncaused. You may try to trace how a thing happens, but you cannot find out why a thing is as it is. A thing is as it is because the universe is as it is. So I'll tell you why I wanted to come back to that particular paragraph. One of the things that we looked at 2 weeks ago, you may remember, was a pretty tough night, but you may remember that. Well, let me put it this way. Let's imagine a machine. Where you can throw in different colors of paint, and you can throw in different textures, some sticky, some soft, some sharp. You can throw in different sounds. It's a pretty magical machine. You can throw in all these different things, and then you crank this wheel, and it mixes all of those things up. And what it does is it creates a long, long sheet of scenery. And it's a pretty magical machine, so it can keep reformulating the colors you threw into it and the sounds you threw into it and the textures you threw into it to make many, many different things as you crank it. So, for example, green is one of the things that you threw into it. But green can be used to make grass. Green can be used to make trees, leaves on trees. Green can be used to make vomit. The green can be used to make a caterpillar, right? Oh yeah, money. How could I forget that one? The green can be used to make money. So as you're cranking this machine with all of your different colors in it, all of your different sounds in it, all of your different textures in it, the same set of colors and sounds and textures a machine cranks makes many, many, many different things. But this machine would be limited by the things that I throw into it. It can't make something completely new. And this we saw last week was one of the problems with the theory of cause and effect. Even with the theory of cause and effect, when you say everything makes everything. Because if everything as it is somehow regurgitated into a next moment, which is different, but it was limited by the everything in the previous moment, you may continue to get different forms and different scenarios, but you're still limited by the everything. I'm making any sense. But what's in this last paragraph that we didn't really have a lot of time to look at is this sentence. The source of all that is the infinite possibility, the supreme reality, which is in you, and which throws its power and light and love on every experience. When I studied interdependent co-arising, which is really Buddha's teaching of the everything makes everything, and I contemplated interdependent co-arising, what I saw was the only way to throw something new into the everything makes everything, or the only way to throw something new into the interdependent co-arising was to throw nothing in it. Nothing is something new. And the way that you throw nothing into it is by abiding as presence instead of believing the form. So let's pretend that this present moment that little machine is cranking out with the everything makes everything, let's pretend like this present moment is a moment when the phone rings. And somebody tells me something, like, I don't know. It's hard for me to make stuff up. But somebody tells me that the stock market has just crashed. I think I saw on the news yesterday that it was up to like 26,000. And let's say it dropped all the way down to 9,500. A huge crash. Well, if I get all freaked out about that, here I am, 50 years old, I don't have hardly any money anyway, and I'm supposed to retire in a couple of years, and now that little bit of nothing is really nothing, and I get all freaked out and start worrying. Well, then I'm believing the form, and all of my emotions and all of my believing just keep the regurgitation of the everything makes everything. I mean, eventually this market goes back up again. This is the way it always works out. Maybe long after I've retired, but eventually it does. Nothing new is added, though. I mean, the machine is going to just keep making stories out of the same everything that it has available to it. But if my friend calls and tells me that the stock market has just crashed, and if I'm enlightened enough to say, is that so? And to remain still, in a genuine, still way, the light that I am shines into the everything makes everything. And it allows it to change. It's like grace gets thrown into the mix. That grace is actually nothing rather than something. But the grace gets thrown into the mix. And this is why the everything makes everything isn't an exact regurgitation of the same stories ever and ever and ever, with nothing ever evolving or changing or improving or more specifically awakening. Because, first of all, we are this infinite possibility, this supreme reality, the light, the love, the power, we are that. And so, because we are that, we can always be that. And when we be that, that throws light and love and power into the regurgitation. And if I'm not enlightened enough when the stock market crashes to just say, is that so? Without anything going on inside. But I am enlightened enough to practice rest, accept, and trust, to recognize, oh my God, I am so freaked out. Oh my God, I am so fearful. But I am going to watch my breath. I'm just going to keep breathing. I see all this fear running through the body. I feel all these emotions, but what I really want is healing. I'm just going to be with this, right? If I'm even that enlightened, even that throws something new into the regurgitation machine, into the everything makes everything, into the interdependent co-arising. So what is able to make an evolution occur rather than just a regurgitation is us abiding as ourself to the best of our ability. So that's what I wanted to go back and add. If it wasn't for us and who we are and our ability to abide as ourself, the world would just be a circular story happening over and over and over again. But because of us, and because of what we are, and because we can always abide as that, there's an evolution occurring, and that evolution is what we call awakening. All right, so with that said, I'm ready to move on to the next conversation, which is called What Is Born Must Die. This is conversation number 5. And again, we have a questioner here. I don't know what tone of voice the questioner has, but the question is the witness consciousness permanent or not? That's the way I hear it in my head. I don't know if that's the tone of voice or not. Is the witness consciousness permanent or not? And here is Nisargadatta's answer. Again, the question is the witness consciousness permanent or not? And the answer, it is not permanent. Now I'm going to just stop right there. Because I know this is true. And in fact, if you're in gentle healing in my own way, I have taught you that this is true through the final lessons not the five final lessons you're on now, but through this I'll call them the special themes, that last part of the workbook, the special themes in A Course in Miracles, when looked at really carefully and really deeply, teaches this. When we went through gentle healing, I talked about how, we awaken to true perception, which I called consciousness. But consciousness is actually not the final awakening. You awaken from this separation consciousness, which is the human dream, to unity consciousness, which most people refer to as awake. But the Course is very clear that what you awaken to in that case is true perception or real world. And it says that the real world is still a dream. And after that, there is another awakening, which the Course in the Course workbook calls the Last Judgment. But there's a second awakening, another awakening, where you awaken beyond perception entirely. And what I talked about in the tips with the gentle healing group was that when you awaken to consciousness, there's still a sense of self. It's not the same sense of self, it's not the same egoic sense of self that you experience within separation consciousness. That egoic sense of self ends or dies, and you awaken to a new sense of self, which is commonly called the I am presence. Here it's being called the witness consciousness. I sometimes call it the subject. It's a more pure sense of self. It's definitely an awakening compared to the previous self. But there's still an I there. It may be I as all of consciousness rather than I as a person, but there's still an I there. In the second awakening, the I, the sense of self, goes completely, completely away. There is no more sense of self. Which is something that the mind can't even imagine. But if the sense of self goes completely away in the second awakening, the final awakening, then that means the sense of self ends. Therefore, it's not permanent. The I am presence has a beginning and an ending. The subject consciousness has a beginning and an ending. And there are still a lot of people out there in the spiritual world today who have not yet realized this. Even people who have awakened to consciousness, they think they're experiencing the final awakening, and yet they aren't. They don't know what they don't know yet. And I think that we're pretty lucky that we've been introduced to teachings like A Course in Miracles and Nisargadatta Maharaj, which are extremely clear about the fact that there are actually two awakenings, not just one. That way we have a conscious knowledge to keep going, right? So this is one of the places where Nisargadatta addresses that very, very clearly. The question again is asking about the witness consciousness, which is beyond separation consciousness. But he says, is the witness consciousness permanent or not? And Nisargadatta says right off the bat, it is not permanent. The knower rises and sets with the known. That's kind of like saying with perception. The witness consciousness rises with perception, but it sets with perception. And again, the Course is very clear that within the real world, there's still perception. It's true perception, but there's still perception. But after God takes the last step and you awaken to heaven, you also, what the Course calls heaven, you also awaken beyond perception entirely. If you're beyond perception entirely, then you're beyond the known or the objects entirely. And so you're also beyond this knower or the object or the witness entirely. So again, is the witness consciousness permanent or not? It is not permanent. Let me pause again. This is also why the Course says that in awakening there is no world. Right, the world is an object, the world is a perception. You have a witnessing consciousness and a perception, a knower and a known. But in the true awakening, or the final awakening, you awaken beyond perception, which also means you awaken beyond the world, and you awaken beyond the witness. And Jay, I am on page, let's see, this page didn't. Page 11, at least in the paperback book. If you have the PDF, I don't know if it's numbered the same. But in my paperback book, it's page 11. It's the beginning of conversation number 5. That would be the same regarding what version you have. Okay, beginning of conversation number 5. So again, is the witness consciousness permanent or not? It is not permanent. The knower rises and sets with the known, that in which both the knower and the known arise and set is beyond time. The words permanent or eternal do not apply. And I think the reason he says the words permanent or eternal do not apply is because really, if you look at the words permanent or eternal, they are concepts which really engage time. I mean, when we think of eternal or eternity, don't we think of time going on and on and on and on and on and on, right? Or permanent, don't we think of for all of time? So, so again, in that way, because of our concepts of what permanent means or what eternal means, you have to be within time. You have to be within perception for there to be a permanent and an eternal. And what he is saying is that, which is our ultimate truth, the final awakening, that is beyond the knower, it's beyond the known, it's beyond time. So the next question is, in sleep, this is funny because this is exactly where my mind went. And I think this happened a lot last time too, that, as I was sharing, a question would arise in my mind and I'd look down the book and I'd find the questioner asking the exact same question. So it looks like this questioner is saying exactly what I was thinking, didn't say. So again, I'm aligned with the questioners. The questioner says, in sleep, there is neither the known nor the knower. What keeps the body sensitive and receptive? So again, in this case, the questioner is talking about the deep sleep, the dreamless sleep. And it's true that when we're in that dreamless sleep, there is no witnessing presence and there's nothing to witness. Yet if your alarm clock goes off, wake up. If the body gets too cold, if you don't have enough blankets on, or if the body gets too hot, you have too many blankets on, you wake up. So that's really, the question is saying there's no knower, there's no known, the world must have disappeared is really what he's saying. But yet, I know if I get too cold, and in fact, I think somebody even said this to me, like within the last week or two, I remember somebody saying this to me. So the question says, in sleep, there is neither the known nor the knower. What keeps the body sensitive and receptive? And Nisargadatta says, surely you cannot say the knower was absent. The experience of things and thoughts was not there. That is all. But the absence of experience is also experience. It is like entering a dark room and saying, I see nothing. A man blind from birth knows not what darkness means. Similarly, only the knower knows that he does not know. Sleep is merely a lapse in memory. Life goes on. So many teachers, I think, probably from the East, from the Hindu tradition, have used this example when trying to explain what awareness beyond consciousness is. They use the example of deep sleep. And so obviously, this questioner has used that example, but that's just an example. That's just an analogy. It's not the truth. Our deep sleep experience is not exactly like awakening or what the Hindus call samadhi. That's just a comparison to help us kind of understand that when there's no witness, there is no world. And so it looks like this person kind of taken that example too literally by saying, hey, well, if I'm if I'm there when I'm in deep sleep, then, well, how come the body's still sensitive or and receptive? How come I still hear my alarm clock? How come I still feel if I'm cold or hot? And so now Nisargadatta is saying, wait a second, that's, even though that example is used a lot, that's not really the same thing. When you go into deep sleep, the You that just that's not the same thing as having awakened beyond consciousness. So since you haven't awakened beyond consciousness, your witnessing presence is still there. You may not have subject object awareness when you're in deep sleep. The knower is still there, the one that knows. I don't remember anything. I didn't, right? So he's just getting real with the guy. He says, surely you cannot say that the knower was absent. I mean, you were just asleep. You weren't awake beyond the knower. The experience of things and thoughts was not there. That's true. There were no objects while you were in deep sleep. The experience of things and thoughts was not there. That's all. But the absence of experience is also experience. Like you recognize the difference between deep sleep, dreaming, and being awake. What recognizes the difference between deep sleep, dreaming, and being awake? The knower, the witness. The witness witnesses the difference and knows the difference. So that proves that the witness is still present. The absence of experience is also experience. It is like entering a dark room and saying, I see nothing, right? So if you go into a dark room and you say, I see nothing, it's the knower that knows she sees nothing, right? A man blind from birth does not know what darkness means. And here the man blind from birth is being used as an analogy for the non-knower, for that which is beyond consciousness. Consciousness is aware of experience, but that which is beyond consciousness is not aware of experience. Just like a man who can see is aware of darkness, but a man who cannot see is not aware of darkness. A man blind from birth knows not what darkness means. Similarly, only the knower knows that he does not know. Sleep is merely a lapse in memory. life goes on. And we all know that's true. We know life goes on. We know that there are other people who are not in bed sleeping when we're in bed sleeping. They're doing other things. We know our heart is still breathing, still beating. We're still breathing. Blood is still being pumped through the body, right? So even though that example is often used to try and help us comprehend that when there is no subject, there is no witness, there is also no world, that is just an example. In reality, if we haven't awakened beyond consciousness, we're just the knower going to sleep for a while. So now the questioner asks, and what is death? And Nisargadatta says, it is the change in the living process of a particular body. Integration ends and disintegration sets in. So pardon Regina while she goes to the dictionary. Because I know. To me, I know what integration means, but it's not making full sense in this particular sentence, so I'm going to look it up, or at least not to me. Integration. Well, that didn't help. It says the action or process of integrating. So let's look up integrate. Integrate. Okay. So to integrate is to combine with another so that they become a whole. So, although he's not going into detail about what's integrating here, I'm going to say that body, mind, personality, life, awareness is all integrated into what appears to be a person. Does that sound right? We take body, mind, personality, life, awareness, and we integrate them together, and we have what appears to be a person. So he's saying death, that integration ends, and disintegration sets in. Disintegration is then to break up into smaller parts, typically as the result of impact or decay. Disintegration. So what is happening is that the coming together of a body, a mind, a personality, life, and awareness, or in this case, really consciousness, the coming together of that is now breaking apart. He doesn't say, at least here, to what degree it breaks apart. We know the body is no longer a part of it. The dead body gets left behind. Just today, my dad turned 80 today. And so I called him to wish him happy birthday. And he asked me, he said, would it be okay with you when I die if I donate my body to science? So they can cut it up and study it. And he says, there's a school near here where they, a university near here where they, they do that kind of thing with the students. And would it be okay with you if I donate my body? And I'm like, well, yeah, as long as I don't have to watch him, as long as I don't have to watch him work on your body, I'm okay with it. Because, and as my dad said, well, it is just a body at that point. And I go, yeah, no, I'm okay with it. That's fine if that's what you want to do. I don't, I'm fine with that. I don't plan on keeping his body as a souvenir or anything. So sure. But that's the whole thing. Not everybody fully accepts the reality of this. At the very least, at the very least, I suspect it's more than this. At the very least, the mind, personality, life, awareness has left the body behind, and at least that much disintegration has occurred. The body is now nothing. If you've ever seen the movie Temple Grandin, when she went to a slaughterhouse, she Temple Grandin has a very intuitive connection to cows. She went to the slaughterhouse, and you know where I'm going with this. She's watching the cows and listening to the cows and really kind of paying attention to the cows, and they bring the cow into the part where they actually kill them. And what they do is they hit them right between the eyes, and they're dead instantly. And so she watches them do this. She watches them hit the cow right between the eyes, and the cow's dead. And she goes like, "Where'd it go?" And she's autistic, so she communicates a little differently. And people are like, "What? What?" She goes, "Well, a second ago, it was a cow. Now it's just meat. It's just meat. Where did it go?" But she sensed the disintegration. Like a second ago, this was a living, breathing, integrated something. Now it's, she called it just meat. It's just meat. Right? Now, I know that we like to think that maybe the rest, those other four parts, the mind, the personality, life, and awareness, continue to stay together, that it's only the body that gets disintegrated. But I suspect, at least with time, I don't know that it happens immediately, because even I've experienced what appears to be those who have passed, and those four were still together, just not the body. But I would imagine with a little more time and a little more detachment, a little more, we'll call it spiritual decay or spiritual disintegration, that additional falling away of those four together happens. Eventually the personality ends, the mind that was the person ends, right? Maybe faster for some, slower for others. Excuse me. So in that way, although most people, even spiritual people that I come across, don't like to think about this, in that way we do die. I mean, Regina's going to end. Regina's not permanent. Of course, Regina's not my true self, and that's the whole purpose of this process that we call the spiritual path, is awakening to that true self, which is beyond this process of integration, which we call birth, and disintegration, which we call death. But that which is integrated or born disintegrates or dies. So the question, what is death? It is the change in the living process of a particular body. Integration ends, and disintegration sets in. Now the questioner says, but what about the would be the witnessing conscience. With the disappearance of the body, does the knower disappear? So now we have a questioner who wants to know just how much disintegration happens in death. But what about the knower? With the disappearance of the body, does the knower disappear? Nisargadatta says, just as the knower of the body appears at birth, so he disappears at death. You guys have a tip coming up in a few days that I've already written that really addresses my dad, the same one who turned 80 today, the same one who asked if he could donate his body to science. Would I be okay with that when he dies? I went hiking with him in southern Missouri in the Ozarks, you know, quite a few years ago. I think about 25 years ago, it was before Jasmine came along. And my dad has never, and this was even before I think I really consider myself on the spiritual path, so it was quite a long time ago. But my dad has never been a religious man. You know, my mom, when my dad and my mom were married, my mom would sometimes go to the Methodist church. My dad didn't go. And his second wife was actually one of Jehovah's Witnesses, but dad never got involved in that. You know, dad's just never been a religious man. So one day while dad and I were out hiking in the Ozarks together, you know, just having conversation while we're walking along, I asked my dad, you know, what his spiritual beliefs were, because I really had no idea. My dad said something, well, Regina, it's like this. Someday I'm going to die. And this was before he had the idea to donate his body to science. He says, someday I'm going to die. And when I do, I'm going to be buried in the ground. Apparently, in my dad's little story, he doesn't have a casket. We're just burying him in the ground. He says, someday I'm going to die. And when I do, I'm going to be buried in the ground, and my body is going to return to dirt. And that, out of that fertile dirt that was my body, plants are going to grow, and birds and animals are going to eat those plants, and then eventually they will die, and their body is going to turn to dirt. Dirt, and more plants will grow, and you know, other birds and animals will eat those plants. And he says, and in that way, I will live forever. The I in that sentence is not Don Akers. The I in that sentence is life itself. Life itself. Even the life that is the fertileness in the soil. And that's really what awakening is about. It's awakening beyond the idea that I am this body, beyond the idea that I am this personality, beyond the idea that I am this mind, even beyond the idea that I am the conscious witness. Because, you know, the fertileness in the soil, we don't think of that as a conscious witness, do we? To the realization that I am life. Beyond the I am, yes, beyond the I am. There is no I am in the fertileness of soil, in the living organisms that make soil fertile, right? There's no I am in that. There's no I am in a leaf. But the life, that's our genuine truth. So Nisargadatta is just, you know, telling the truth as good as my dad does. Just as the knower of the body appears at birth, so he disappears at death. And again, I'm not certain, just based on my own experience, that that's immediate. You know, he says the disintegration begins. I mean, I even have a picture that I carry around on my phone of a ghost that I saw and interacted with a real ghost, and I took a picture and I carry that picture around, because that's just, I don't know if I'll ever get the chance to take a picture of a ghost again. But there was something there that appeared to be even I mean, you can see this person's face. You can see this person's face. So even though there's not a physical body, there's still some kind of an image body, right? There's still a personality, a mind, and of course, life awareness is there too. And I don't know when this ghost died or how long this ghost has been around, but the disintegration is not complete. And so we don't know that death, the full death, of the or the full disintegration is, it may not be immediate, and it may vary depending on the willingness of the letting of the knower to let go, right? It may vary. Some people may let go immediately. Some may hang around for a short time. Some may let go. So it's almost like there's a death and then maybe another death or something. In fact, I just read something today about an immediate death, an immediate disintegration. Let me read that to you. It's just one little paragraph. It's an excerpt from a book, and I haven't read the entire book. Here's what the paragraph says regarding one character in a Michael Connelly novel. So it doesn't even mention the name of the novel. Regarding one character in a Michael Connelly novel, he was long past believing in God. The horrors he had seen documented had, little by little, sapped his stories of faith. In those seemingly final days, as his own heart withered and tapped out its final cadences, he did not grasp desperately for his lost faith as a shield or a means of easing the fear of the unknown. Instead, he was accepting of the end, of his own nothing. Nothingness. He was ready. It was easy to do. Now that's the only excerpt that's there, so I don't know anything else about this story. But you can see, by coincidence, I happen to have read this about an hour ago, as coincidences go. But you can see this is describing a disintegration process that happened very quickly. Because the knower was no longer trying to hold the integration together. He was accepting of the end, of his own nothingness. He was ready. It was easy to do. So, what about the knower? With the disappearance of the body, does the knower disappear? Nisargadatta. Just as the knower of the body appears at birth, so he disappears at death. And then the questioner, and nothing remains? Now you guys know my dad's answer to this. Nisargadatta's is really the same. Life remains. Consciousness needs a vehicle and an instrument for its manifestation. When life produces another body, another knower comes into being. So, really, not only is life remaining here, but consciousness is remaining here because he says that consciousness needs a vehicle and an instrument. So consciousness is still here too, just not the knower. We are all knowers. We know right now whatever we're experiencing. And we think of that knower as I. It's the I am presence, the sense of self. And as long as we're identified with that, then we are deluded regarding our truth because we are not this temporary, impermanent knower. And it's really good just to, be with this. I mean, we just saw in this, it's a story, it's a novel, a story, but we just saw how this one character was okay with being nothing and able to completely let go. And again, we don't have enough of a story there to know whether that's talking about ego death or physical death. I mean, we know there's a physical death happening because the heart's giving out, but is this also the end of it, of an ego? Is this also an ego death too? Because I have also heard that sometimes ego death and physical death happens at the same time. So maybe that's a story about that, but we don't know because we don't have enough information. But even if the body is not dying, even if the body is continuing, the ego death is the death of the sense of self. The ego death is the death of the idea that I am something. The ego death is the death of the knower. It's beyond perception entirely. This isn't anything that we can imagine, but this is a teaching that we can marinate in, that somehow we can let the cells of our body accept. So that when the opportunity for ego death comes, and that realization that the knower that we think we are is ending, is something that we're prepared for. Even though we have no idea what it's like to be life without being a knower. And therefore, we can allow it to happen. As Dr. David Hawkins said in one of the two videos that I shared a couple weeks ago, it was actually the second video, the optional one. He talked about another thing that we need to practice in this lifetime in order to prepare ourselves for ego death. He said, we have to learn whenever there's fear to just keep walking, not to let fear stop us, because you can just begin to imagine. I mean, look at how much you think you are the knower, the experiencer, the witness, right? So imagine now you're faced with the realization that that, which is what you think you are, is about to end forever. Imagine the fear. Dr. David Hawkins said it was intense. It only lasted about a minute or so, but it was intense. He also said something like 85% of the people who get to this point turn back. Imagine how accustomed you have to be to continue walking through fear at that point. And all we can do is be with that. I mean, I can't think of any other way to prepare ourselves but to look at this dead honest and be with it. So again, after the knower ends, nothing remains. And Nisargadatta says, life remains. Consciousness needs a vehicle and an instrument for its manifestation. When life produces another body, another knower comes into being. We have 4 minutes left. I'll read the next question and answer, but if we need to, this is where we'll start in 2 weeks as well. So the next question is there a causal link between the successive body knower or body mind? And Nisargadatta says, yes. There is something that may be called the memory body or the causal body, a record of all that was thought, want, and done. It is like a cloud of images held together. So this is what we would call maybe the soul. So now we know that disintegration is not complete. And again, the knower, what we think of as me, goes away, but there's still consciousness, and there's still the imprints on consciousness that occurred with this, for lack of better words, I'll call it a soul. And so when the reincarnation happens and this imprint enters into another body, this unconscious memory body, he's calling it, is there. And this is why things can be true, like the spiritual progress you make in this lifetime continues in the next lifetime. Even though the conscious knower ends and another conscious knower is born, the memory body, the unconscious memory body, goes with it. So it's kind of like death without death. Isn't that interesting? So even though you die, your karma is what people call it, right? Is maintained. So when, not really you anymore, but this new knower is born, the awakening of that aspect of consciousness can continue from where it left off with the old knower. Now that puts a whole different spin on reincarnation, because somehow people think that there's an I that goes from one lifetime to another, and this appears to be the end of one eye and the beginning of a new eye, but a continuation of an imprint on consciousness. So what we think we are, based on this teaching, I certainly don't have direct experience myself, because I don't remember knowing prior to this lifetime, right? And if I'm a knower that was born, I wouldn't. So what this teaching is saying is that the being that we think we are will end. And as we all know, awakening is allowing that ending to occur. I want to say before the body dies, but like I said, sometimes I think it can happen as the body dies. But it's more consciously allowing that ending to occur and a willingness to go beyond what you thought you were to something else. Instead of the ending just occurring because the body died. Right? It's consciously allowing that ending to occur. Oops, and I just noticed I'm a minute after. So we'll have to finish this in 2 weeks. All right, thanks, you guys. Bye. What do I want to title this program? Let's go with the title of this particular message, What is Born Must Die. Bye.